Okay. So, first of all, my talk will follow a handout, and you all have it, but here it is on the screen. I should tell you also, Ulrike just suggested that I could go a little bit over an hour, and this is more or less the scariest thing.
No, you can do an hour, and then there's a break, and then there could be more
explanation. But that's even scarier, because sort of the very end, I didn't review. So, I mean, it's all true, I know it, I implemented it on, you know, I've run computer programs to compute these things. Everything works. But if you sort of press me for the details, I haven't thought about it for a long time, so I don't know. Oh, no, okay. Anyway, a few highlights. Oh, okay, also, since I know I will not get to the end, let me start from a few highlights. So, there will be a kind of reasonably defined invariant of things. I'll talk about what the things are later. But then I'll add to it some spice called J, and I don't really understand J. I mean, I can prove it exists, I can compute it. I, in some sense, know where it's coming from. You should pick up a copy of the handout. But I don't really understand it, and Martin will explain it to me at the end of the hour. Second piece of highlight, so this J in particular leads to an invariant of tangles with values in basically colored rings, colored wheels. So, well, basically take an algebra with the free associative algebra with generators, the components of the tangles, so-called the colors of the components of the tangle, and then mod out by moving the tail of the word to the head of the word. So essentially you get cyclic words. So you get things that look like that. And so I get an invariant of tangles with values, linear combinations of such things. And I don't know why one should expect one. I know why I'm getting one. But I don't know why one should expect one. And again, Martin will tell us. Part of the point is that that invariant is completely computable. So, and in fact, the whole purpose, so in fact, such invariants were predicted, or it's clear that they exist, from the perspective of finite type invariants and the Concievich integral, and you look at the one loop part of that Concievich integral, and somehow such invariants were expected before. The news is that I can actually compute everything. Okay, and here it is. This is here is one specific two-component tangle. You type it in using some simple-minded coding, which I will not explain. You hit enter, and the computer spits out the values. And well, it's a bit hard to sort of see that this is the same as you know, those nice colorful rings, but it really is. So this is a series of cyclic word series. And here are cyclic words that appear in it, and unfortunately they're not as colorful, but things are actually very computable. Okay, so the next highlight, so I'm going through the highlights because I know I will not get to all of these points actually in the talk. So the next highlight is that somehow the trick for the computation has to do with sort of Peter Pan. So, you know, Peter Pan has this unique feature that he can break away from his shadow, or more so the shadow can break away from him, and they have somehow an independent life. And the analogy in knot theory is that the strands of a knot play a dual role. So on one hand, they create the fundamental group of the complement of the knot. And on the other hand, they are elements in the fundamental group of the complement of the knot. Because you can always, you know, if you have a knot, you can always sort of draw a little parallel to it. And that parallel is an element in the fundamental group of the complement of the knot. And so when you modify knots, when you play around with knots, both the elements that you investigate and the group that's built around, in which they live, change at the same time, and that makes computations difficult, as it turns out. And what happens in what I will tell you about is that somehow I will split the knot from its shadow, and this will allow for better computations. Next point is, so why bother? Sorry, so again, this is the highlight. I'm still advertising, okay? So next point is, so I will get this invariant with values in essentially a non-commutative world. So rings with colored beads, okay? But if you look at somehow the most minimally non-commutative, so almost totally commutative quotient of that world in this, in which this invariant lives, you will get a certain invariant which turns out to be a generalization, or a, not quite a generalization, well, a new perspective of the so-called Alexander polynomial. So the Alexander polynomial is one of the most basic invariants in knot theory, and one of its lovely properties is that it can be computed relatively quickly. So it can be computed in, well, if you have a knot with n crossings, it can be computed in roughly n cubed time, because it's essentially the computation of a determinant. Now, that's extremely good relative to things like the Jones polynomial, but still, if you actually try to compute the invariant of a knot, then you write a certain matrix, and there is completely a rational reason why to write this matrix, and then you feed it into the determinant computation algorithm. You shut your eyes for time n cubed, you wait, the algorithm does row and column operations, and these row and columns operations have no meaning in topology whatsoever. But at the end, the algorithm spits out an answer which is meaningful, the Alexander polynomial. So what this thing will do is it will put n stepping stones in the middle of the computations, and for at each stepping stone, the thing being computed, something gets computed, and the thing being computed is the invariant of something, is the actual invariant of something that's being, or some piece of the knot. Okay? And in between any two stepping stones, it's just n squared of more or less meaningless computations, but not too meaningless. Row and column of, well, things that have relatively simple-minded formulas. So in some sense, it's a much better Alexander polynomial than other people know. And then the final bit of advertisement before I really start is that invariant, which I will compute, has a quantum field theoretic interpretation, or a presumed quantum field theoretic interpretation. So there is something called the BF topological quantum field theory, and it seems that what I'm going to tell you about is a complete evaluation of this BFTQFT. Okay? Okay, so now the actual scheme of the talk. So I will tell you about balloons and hoops in R3. So one of them is Peter Pan and the other is the shadow, and I'm not sure which is which, okay? But I mean, I will tell you about balloons and hoop in R3 and what kind of algebraic structure they have. So you can do operations on them, and in fact with those operations they turn out to be a finitely presented, or well, with some small print, a finitely presented space. And furthermore, it turns out to contain knot theory within it. Okay? So somehow it makes sense to think about balloons and hoop in R4 rather than about knots in R3. Then I will present an ansatz. So basically I will dictate how to form an invariant. I will give the formulas and that's it. Okay? And I will tell you that it's computable and related to finite type invariant and to BF. And then I will tell you that a certain almost commutative reduction of this invariant, which is sort of a priori very non-commutative, is this ultimate Alexander polynomial. Okay, are you with me? Are you okay? Okay. So let me tell you about balloons and hoops. So these are the main characters in the story. So, well, okay, first of all, everything is happening in either R4 or S4, and it doesn't really matter which one, because they differ by one point, often conveniently called infinity, and sort of in as much as embeddings of one-dimensional or two-dimensional things are concerned, there is no difference. So let's draw everything in R4 or think in S4, I don't care. A balloon is a two-dimensional sphere. It has to have a label, so maybe an integer, maybe a letter. It has to have a name. It has to be oriented, but I will ignore these orientations for much of what I will talk about, for much of this talk. A hoop is a one-dimensional loop. And again, it has to be oriented and it has a label. The balloons are attached by a string to a base point, and the hoops are also attached by a string to a base point. Often I'll take the base point to be infinity when it's convenient. And then a KBH, so a KBH, or the space of knotted balloons and hoops with M balloons and N hoops, will be the space of all embeddings of this gadget into R4, taken modulo isotopy, deformations, topological equivalence in some sense. Okay? And I may or may not impose the condition that the embedding will be a ribbon embedding, and I think I'd rather not even talk about it at this point. Okay? So is it clear what a KBH is? So, you know, this picture is here for beauty only. Okay. So, a few examples. So, here is the sort of identity hoop embedding. So, this is a KBH in which n is equal to 1, and, sorry, m is equal to 0, n is equal to 1. So, it has only one hoop. And this hoop goes from minus infinity to infinity, so it just looks like, and infinity is just one, okay, I'm in S4, so it just looks like a straight line, and in some sense it's the identity and it's not terribly interesting. Okay? Second example is epsilon u, so this is the single balloon knot, which again is somehow unknotted. Okay, but let me tell you how to interpret this picture. So, in general, I draw pictures in R3. Well, actually, I draw them in R2. Okay, but there are standard conventions for how to interpret things in R3 as if in R2 as if they were in R4. Right? When we draw a cube, we all know how to interpret it in R4. Okay. So, like, this sort of makes sense in the picture drawn here. Probably you all kind of see what it is in R3. Okay? So anyway, things are drawn in R3. And whenever you see a balloon, or whenever you see a tennis racket, the way you interpret it as a balloon is as follows. You replace the kind of membrane of the racket by two parallel membranes. You push one of them up in the T direction, and so in the fourth dimension, and one of them down in the fourth dimension by an amount that is proportional to the distance from the boundary. So the boundary hardly gets pushed, and the middle gets pushed relatively far away. Okay? So as a picture in R3, it's a tennis racket, right, or a ping pong racket, but it really stands for a balloon in R4. Okay? Now, with this in mind, here is the next example. So, let's call it rho plus of u and x. So it has one balloon labeled u and one hoop labeled x. Again, the hoop is unknotted. It goes from minus infinity to, well, it goes from infinity to infinity. The balloon, again, has a string attaching it to the base point, which happens to be infinity. When you view this thing as if it is happening in R3, it appears to be singular because x punctures through the membrane of u. But remember that this membrane gets pushed up or down, so and the blue line never gets pushed. The blue line lives in the t equals zero part of R4. So this is non-singular. And in fact, it's sort of a Hopf-Link, if you know what the Hopf-Link is. So it's actually the simplest knotted thing you can draw using my objects, using my balloons and hoops. Are you okay? This is the same, except the only difference is that here the x punctures u from below up, and here it punctuates from up to under. And there is some sign convention which makes this a positive sort of meeting, and this is a negative meeting, but I don't think I want to go through the sign convention. Okay? Good. Here's a more sophisticated example. So, this example has two balloons. So, like, both of them look like sausages or bananas or something. Okay, so both of them are kind of, well, like the balloons that appear here. Okay? And it has two hoops. So, the bottom hoop, this one, and this one. And if you look at it, you'll notice several things. Here, the hoop seems to cross itself. So the reason it does that is because one-dimensional things in R4 are actually not knotted. There is no over or under in R4. You can go from over to under by going through time-like relative to each other. Okay? So I didn't even bother to specify if this is over or under. I could have specified, but it doesn't matter. Okay. Likewise, I suppose over here, I did specify that blue goes behind red, but had it been above red, it would be the same. Four-dimensionally. Okay? On the other hand, this is non-trivial. This crossing here is non-trivial, and you cannot slide blue out. Okay? Likewise, this crossing of red and red, of a balloon with itself, is non-trivial. First of all, it's non-singular. It appears singular, but it actually isn't, because, again, things get pushed out, and the narrower band gets pushed out less than the wider band, so it's actually non-trivial. And it is non-trivial, okay? And another comment, so over here, I could actually slide the tip of this balloon out, okay? So this is a non-trivial KBH, but I didn't say that it's in its minimal embedding. I could simplify a bit, but once I push this out, I think there is nothing else I can do. Okay? I should say also that this particular KBH is in the image of a map delta, which is defined on tangles. So what's a tangle? A tangle is a three-dimensional object, and what it is a partial picture of a knot drawn inside some small domain in the plane. So you can see the tangle here, okay? It's like a knot, except, well, it has two components, and it's, well, it's partial, it's not closed, okay? Now, there is a map from tangles to KVHs, and I think the map is best defined by a picture, and here's the picture. So, basically, you replace every component of the tangle by a pair of parallel, one hoop and one balloon. The balloon has a string connecting it to the, basically to infinity, near the end of the component, near the head of the component. And this is happening twice. So it's happening, well, here, and it's also happening for the sort of longer component, basically all the way around here. And then there is a certain simple-minded rule how to replace the crossings by fancy crossings of a balloon hoop pair with another balloon hoop pair. In fact, here are the rules. So delta will map a crossing, well, a positive crossing, I suppose, to a local picture like this, that looks like this, and the opposite for the opposite picture, okay? Now, the story can be slightly extended, because it actually also makes sense for three-dimensional tangles that have another type of crossings, so-called virtual crossings. So a virtual crossing is a crossing in which the sense has not been specified. Okay? So in which you didn't specify whether things go over or under. So you just draw them like that, and the map delta, or the extended delta, will map things like that to things which in R4 are unspecified. So actually I did specify the sense here, but specifying this way is equivalent to specifying it the opposite way. Okay? So delta actually makes sense on usual tangles. This is the U. But it also can be extended to virtual tangles. So these are tangles that have an extra type of crossings, the so-called virtual crossings. And let me tell you what W tangles are in a second. Okay? Well, the next thing to check is that delta is well defined. So, you know, there are the Rademeister moves of knot theory. So, well, this is equivalent to that in ordinary knot theory. Okay? So you can apply delta to... Sorry, I failed to continue this line. So you can apply delta to both sides of this picture, and then it's a sort of lovely exercise to check that the two sides, right here you will get three balloons and three hoops, and here you will get three balloons and three hoops, and it's a lovely exercise to check that they are topologically equivalent. Okay? Now, furthermore, the same is true, there is also somehow a virtual move, a Rademeister move for virtual crossings. So if you have three crossings whose sense has not been specified, then this is equivalent to that. And you can check, or this is declared equivalent to that, and you can check that the map delta will map the left-hand side to the same thing as the right-hand side. Okay? So, delta really is well-defined. Furthermore, there is one additional rule that delta satisfies, and this is the so-called overcrossings commute relation. So, basically, it's the relation that says that if you go over the backslash and then the slash, so think I'm walking along this strand. Then first I go over backslash, then over slash. And here, I first go over slash and then over backslash. And the relation says that Well, the two overcrossings, over slash, then over backslash, commute. So, over slash, over backslash is the same as over back, over slash. Okay? And the little topological picture that explains it appears here. So, if you look at the essential part, or maybe the pink part of my definition of delta, so the blue part is easier. So if you look at the pink part of the definition of delta, you will find that, well, this gets mapped to a certain ribbon, a certain band. Backslash gets mapped to a certain band. The non-crossing gets mapped to what is four-dimensionally a non-crossing. The overcrossing gets mapped to a wide and a narrow penetrating through it, and likewise for this one. And, well, the right-hand side will become the right-hand side here, and four-dimensionally it's clear that you can slide this one down and you'll get to here without singularities. Okay? However, the opposite of this relation does not hold. The undercrossing commute relation does not hold. So the undercrossing commute relation will be the relation that you presumably will or could have gotten if you replace, well, basically, if this sort of strand here goes under the other two and you would attempt to slide it down. And that relation does not work because, well, the little picture that shows it is here. If you start on, I guess, the right here with the horizontal strand going under, which translates to being narrower, and you try to push it up, well, you can see that it just doesn't work. Okay? So, W tangles are V tangles, so tangles with extra virtual crossings, modulo extra, one extra relation, but not modulo the sort of somehow the other relation. So, somehow the symmetry between over and under gets broken. Anyway, theorem, or a bunch of statements, okay? So, sorry, are you still okay? Are you with me? Am I going too slow, too fast? Are you asleep already?
No.
Okay. So, first of all, this map delta, which maps three-dimensional, well, it maps three-dimensional tangles into knotted balloons and hoop. But, you know, every three-dimensional knot is in particular a tangle. Because, well, you know, if you have a knot, you can always draw it as a long knot. And unfortunately, I have zero talent for drawing knots, so it doesn't look like a knot, but I really mean it to be not a knot. And, well, a long knot is just a tangle, right? So therefore, this knot corresponds to some four-dimensional KBH with one balloon and one hoop. Right, that follow the trace sort of parallel to this strand. Okay? So, the claim is that delta injects U-knots into things in R4. You don't lose any information. And the proof is very easy. Basically, you look at the fundamental group of the complement, and it turns out that it makes sense on before delta, it makes sense after delta, and delta maps the fundamental group to the fundamental group. And furthermore, the fundamental group of a knot essentially detects it. So the fundamental group of the complement of a knot essentially detects it. So the proof of that is very easy. And very likely the same is true for U-tangles, but I actually don't know sufficiently well the honest three-dimensional topology to swear on that. Okay? Also, well, okay, I essentially already told you what the kernel of the map delta, or some things that are contained in the kernel of the map delta. So, well, this overcrossings commute is in the kernel of the map delta, and there is a tiny bit more, but this is the most interesting bit. Conjecture, this is all. This remains a conjecture, and essentially it's the conjecture that says that four-dimensional topology has a Rademeister-like description. or that particular bit of four-dimensional topology has a Rademeisterli-like description, I don't know how to prove it. Later, I will define invariants by defining their values on the generators and mod out by relations, and check that the relations are satisfied. So, strictly speaking, since I don't know yet all the relations, I will not be defining invariants. It's only conjecturally that I will be defining invariants. However, the relations that I do know are sufficient to make delta well-defined. So, at least when you restrict your attention to ordinary knot theory, you will get honest invariants. Okay? And maybe one last point. Well, delta is definitely not surjective. And this is because the image of delta, right, if you map a three-dimensional thing into four dimensions, you will always get the same number of balloons as hoops. So no way delta could be surjective. I mean, I never said that the number of balloons should be equal to the number of hoops. However, if you allow puncturing and cuts, so if you allow to pop balloons and to cut hoops, in other words, removing components, delta becomes surjective. So, in other words, if you give me any honest KBH with an unequal number of balloons and hoops, I can find a KBH in the image of delta, so that if you remove some of the components, you will get the KBH you started from. So delta is practically onto. Okay. Okay.
So yeah. Are you in particular saying that it's onto when n and m are equal?
Sorry. When particular, it's onto. But oh, but it's sorry. Even when n and m are onto, I might have to generate a slightly bigger knot, a slightly bigger KBH, and then delete an equal number of balloons and hoops. Okay? So again, basically what I'm saying is that for any KBH, there is a more complicated KBH in the image of delta, so that after deleting some components, you get the one you wanted. Okay. Now, the point about this space of KBHs is that it carries a very interesting algebraic structure. This is, by the way, unlike ordinary knots. Ordinary knots have basically no algebraic structure. Well, there is a connected sum operation, but by no means ordinary knots are finitely generated using connected sum. Okay? So, unlike this, knotted balloons and hoops have an interesting algebraic structure, which makes the space, well, conjecturally finitely presented, and in fact, finitely presented for all the purposes that I might need. Okay? So, let me tell you what these operations are. So, well, one operation or one set of operations is punctures and cuts, and I've already explained it. You can drop a component. Okay?
So, just be clear. So these things you drop, they don't have to be homotopically trivial.
No. I mean, but you can sort of, if you've generated something complicated, you can forget a part of it. Okay? Now, here come the more interesting operations. So, the least of the most interesting operation is the connected sum operation. So, if I have one KBH and another KBH, and the set of names of the balloons for this one is different, is disjoint from the set of names here, otherwise you don't know what to glue means. You will not know how to name components. And likewise, for the set of labels of the hoops, so this set is disjoint from that set, then you can glue the two along the base point. And you can check that this is well defined. So I've drawn it schematically, as sort of without indicating that the balloon is actually knotted with the hoop and with itself. Okay? But you can check that it's well defined, even though this is knotted and this is knotted. Okay? So then come the fun operations.
Does this not correspond to disjoint union of...
This corresponds to disjoint union of tangles, yes.
Tangles.
So, you know, if you have two tangles, you can put them side by side without any linkage between them, and that's what it corresponds to. You still can't get very far with this operation, but now come the operations that actually get you far. Okay? So, the point is, okay, it's sort of, it's a bit analogous to ordinary homotopy theory. So in homotopy theory, pi 1 is a group, and it has a composition operation. Pi 2 is an abelian group, so it also has a composition operation. And furthermore, pi 1 always acts on pi 2. Now, more or less the same happens here. So if you have a KBH, here is the input KBH, and well, it may have more components, but I just choose to emphasize a component called U, a component called V, a component called X, a component called Y. These are hoops, these are balloons. And these, of course, could be knotted. I mean, in the schematic drawing, they're not knotted, but they are knotted when they're embedded in R4. Okay? So, one operation is to, well, concatenate two of the hoops. So, instead of going... So delete the old X and Y and replace them by a single component Z which traces first along Z and then along Y. Okay? And this is, I call it the head multiply or hoop multiply of X and Y outputting the, naming the output Z. By the way, I write operations on the right rather than on the left. I write them on the right, period. And notice that, well, it's sort of like multiplication in pi 1, but it's not multiplication in pi 1. Multiplication in pi 1 is a binary operation. This is a unary operation. It takes as an input a single KBH, when it produces out as an output a single KBH, and if you try to make it a binary operation, it would be much less interesting because as a binary operation, the two paths that you start with are not linked with each other in any meaningful sense. Whereas here, the two components could be linked with each other and with the other components. And, well, okay. Likewise...
So your loops must have an orientation, I guess, in order to...
Yeah, they had an orientation two slides ago, but several slides ago.
Sorry.
But I stopped noting it, okay? But it's still there, mm-hmm. Okay? Likewise, there is something parallel to multiplication by in pi 2, and I call it the, well, it's the balloon multiply, but for some other reason I like to call it the tail multiplying. So it's the tail multiply of a balloon U with a balloon V outputting a balloon labeled W. And what it is you merge the two balloons by somehow connecting their necks along the string that connects them to infinity. Okay? And if you think about it, it's exactly like multiplication in pi 2. Okay? And finally, there is a tail by head action of a tail U, so a balloon U, acted on by an X, by a hoop X. And what it is, it's again the exact analog of the way pi 1 acts on pi 2. So basically you take the string of the balloon and you reroute it along one of the hoops. Okay? And alternatively you can sort of pull the entire neck of the balloon and reroute it along the hoop X. And again, both of these operations are, in ordinary homotopy theory, are binary, but for me they are unary operations. Okay? And one last point, uh, or One more point. So the reason this red heart balloon is here is, first of all, because it's nice. And secondly, because it sort of has the two operations, two of the operations in it. So, you know, the sort of the fact that it has two lobes is somehow the same as the multiplication in pi 2. And you know, when you have a balloon, one thing you like to do with it is to knot the neck so that the air doesn't run out, right? And that's exactly what this last operation does. This could be knotted, right? Okay. Now, these operations have properties. And the properties, well, and the properties are much like the property, well, basically like the properties of homotopy theory. So first of all, there is an associativity property. So if you take the head multiply of A and B, store the answer in A, and then head multiply it with C and store the answer in A, that's the same as B and C multiplying B and C, storing the answer in B, and then multiplying A and B, storing the answer in A. That's essentially associativity. It amounts to saying that if you had three hoops, then, well, I think it's clear, right? Likewise for tail multiply, and, well, it's like associativity, but I like to call it meta-associativity, because it's an associativity expressed in terms of unary operations. Okay. Then, whenever one group acts on another, there are two extra properties. So first of all, when you act on a product, it's like acting on the first, and then acting on the second, right? And the second property is when you act by a product, it's like acting by the first component of the product and then by the second factor. Okay. So there are similar axioms here, and they are written, well, in my language, in the proper language, here. And these are somehow axioms that this algebraic structure satisfies. So in fact, let me give a name for this algebraic structure. I'll call it an MGA, or a meta-group action. So it's like a group action of one group on another, but it's meta because the binary things became unary. And a meta-group action is a collection of sets, one corresponding to it, to each set of labels for hoops and or for tails, and one corresponding to a set of labels for heads. So for each such pair of sets of labels, you get a set of all embeddings, or maybe a set of all, well, other things, if it's a different algebraic structure, if it's a different instance, with operations like this, so tail multiply, head multiply, and THA, tail by head action, which satisfies these axioms. Okay? And then, it's not difficult to show that the four elements shown here, generate the MGA KBH, so the algebraic structure, knotted balloons and hoops, using these operations. Okay, so if ever I will want to construct an invariant of KBHs, it's enough to define it on the, well, it's enough to find a target space on which the same operations are defined and the same axioms hold. And then it's enough to give an ansatz for the values of the generators and verify that the relations are satisfied. Okay. Maybe one last thing before moving on,
you say generated, it's more like detectable or something.
Generated. You can write every KBH by taking a number of copies of those basic KBHs, row plus and row minus, and then merging these copies using the connected sum operation. And then, well, I mean, this would still be sort of trivial, but after you do that, you can just apply a sequence of these operations and you'll get anywhere you want. That's the claim. Okay? So one little extra point, so whenever you have one group acting on another, you can form their semi-direct product. Okay? So there is a similar notion of meta-semi-direct product over here. So basically, there is a formula for a double multiply, so multiplying a pair by another pair, and the way you multiply a pair by another pair is first you act on the tail by the head, then you multiply the tail, then you multiply the heads. And the claim is that these axioms imply that this thing is meta-associative. So is associative in the same sense that in which these are associative. And furthermore, here is another example of a meta-associative space. So tangles themselves have an operation, so if you have a tangle with several components, there is an operation of connecting the end of one component to the tail of another. Okay? So basically, if you have a tangle with three components, here they are drawn as if they are not knotted. But of course I mean that they are knotted. Okay? There is the operation of connecting the head of this to the tail of that. You will get something that schematically looks like this. But of course it's still knotted. Then there is the operation of connecting the head of this to the tail of that, and you'll get this. And there is a certain associativity in the sense that if you connect these two and then this, it's the same as connecting the last two and then connecting the result to that. So in both cases, you'll get this picture. Okay? So basically what I'm saying, or what I want to say, is that in some sense, concatenation of tangles in my scheme becomes the fact, well, becomes the semi-direct product of pi 1 and pi 2. Okay? So, so the claim is that the map delta that I defined before intertwines this double multiplication, so this strange multiplication defined on KBHs, with the ordinary tangle concatenation. So sort of, I don't know, I think this on its own is lovely. Somehow the claim is a sort of ordinary three-dimensional topology is more or less pi 1 semi-direct product, pi 2, if you're thinking about embeddings one dimension higher. Okay? And this is somehow the place where Peter Pan appears, because in four dimensions, the balloons make pi 1, and the hoops measure pi 1. The hoops are elements in pi 1, and the balloons, well, the complement of the balloons, make the pi 1. And sort of in tangles, they go together, but in four dimensions, I'm allowing myself to let them be separate. Okay. Anyway, so again, just to repeat what I'm seeking invariants that will respect this algebraic structure. So I'm seeking target spaces that will have the same sort of operations defined on them, and then once I have such a target space, I can define the invariant by just defining it on the generators and verifying the relations. So I'll give you example number 0, okay? Example number 0 is, well, just the fundamental group of the complement. So if you have a KBH gamma with m balloons and n hoops, I can map it to, well, it's a little bit more than a fundamental group. So I can map it to a triple in which the first member of the triple is the fundamental group of the complement of gamma. So again, this is determined only by the balloons. Okay? And then two sequences in elements in it. The sequence ui, which is the sequence of meridians of the balloons. So every balloon comes with a distinguished element of the fundamental group of the complement, and schematically I draw it as a blue arrow going sort of under the balloon near the base point. And what it is you trace the string of the balloon too near the base point, then you sort of loop around the balloon, again in R4 you can do it, and come back along the string. Okay? So this will be U1, there will similarly be a U2. And then, so this gives you the list UI, and there is a similar list, XJ, of elements in the fundamental group, one corresponding for each hoop. So the hoop itself is just an element in pi 1 of the complement. Okay? And then, so I've actually finished the definition of the invariant. Okay? But I claim that you can, well, okay, sorry. First of all, it's a lovely invariant, but it's not terribly computable because it's usually very hard to tell whether two groups are equal to each other. Okay, so it's a nice abstraction, but it's not very useful for actual computations. This said, this invariant has the required properties to be called a homomorphic invariant. So, in other words, its target space has all the relevant operations, and therefore I could have defined it by simply stating its values on the generators. So let me tell you how the operations act on this invariant, okay? Namely on the target space of this invariant. So it's all of this is very basic, elementary, sort of first-year algebraic topology class, okay? So basically, if you merge two KBHs, the operation that it induces on the fundamental groups of the complement is the free product. So you just take the free product of the two corresponding groups, and you concatenate the list of meridians, and you concatenate the list of hoops, of longitudes. The operation of tail multiply acts on the fundamental group of the complement by, so basically if I merge these two balloons, what happens is that I mod out by the relation that sets U1 to be equal to U2. So the meridians of these two balloons become equal. So the operation tail multiply is essentially, well, merges two elements of the group. You mod out the group by setting an equality between two of its elements. The head multiply operation, or the hoop multiply operation, just takes two elements of this list and multiplies them. Okay? And finally, the tail by head action, so that's a bit tricky, and maybe I should show it on the picture here. So how are the meridians of, so how is the meridian of U before the operation related to the meridian after the operation? So basically, what's the relationship between going straight from here to here, doing a little loop and coming back, to going all the way around, doing a little loop and coming back along x? So the relation is, well, conjugation. So the old meridian is somehow a conjugate of the new meridian. And what it means algebraically is that the corresponding THA operation takes a group pi with a special element u in it, another special element x in it, and produces a new group with a new special element u bar, which is a conjugate of the old you. The way you do it, group theoretically, is you take the free product of pi with a group with one generator, and you mod out by the relation u is equal to x u bar x inverse. Okay? Good. So I just gave you an example of a homomorphic invariant, and again, it works, but it's not terribly useful because it's not computable. So let me propose a way of making it perhaps more computable. Okay? Except it will be a failure. Okay? So the idea will be to say the following. Well, at least initially, when the balloons are not yet knotted with each other, the fundamental group of the complement is a free group on the letters U1, U2, and so on. So at least initially, the X's, the hoops, or at least in the case where the balloons are unknotted, the hoops are simply words in the U's. So let me try to trace how the words in the U's change as I do operations. If they change in a manageable way, my invariant will simply be write each of the X's as a word in the U's. Okay? So at first it looks good. So if you have two words, so if you're trying to do the head multiply, so if you try to concatenate two loops, you just concatenate the corresponding words. If you merge two balloons, it means that you identify two letters. You can just identify the two letters in all the words that appear. The problems occurs when you're trying to do the group action, so the tail by head action. And the reason is basically the following. So you see, I had X, or I had the X's written as a word in the U's, and now I want to replace every occurrence of U1 by its conjugate by X. Well, this I can do. So every place I see U1 everywhere in my list of words, I replace U1 by U1 conjugated by X. But the problem is that X might in itself has the letter U1 appearing in it. So now I need to carry out this replacement again. And then I'm trying to rewrite everything in terms of the new generator, U bar, but the process doesn't terminate. Okay? So, I mean, I wrote it here with slightly more detail, but I don't think I want to go through it. So that's a failure, unfortunately. However, if you switch to a suitable completion in which iterated conjugations converge, then this works. And that's the next invariant. So the next attempt on an invariant, which is successful, is the following. So basically what I do is I switch from words in an associative algebra or in the freely in a free group to their logarithms, which are elements in the free algebra, in the freely algebra. So basically I let FL be the freely algebra generated by the set of balloons, and my primary part of the invariant will be a list of elements of FL, one corresponding for each hoop. So it's like one element in the free group for each hoop. Okay? So schematically, well, elements of the freely algebra look like trees with labels in the set of the balloons. So for one hoop, I'll have one tree. For another hoop, I'll have, well, a linear combination of other trees. And the operations now make sense. So the operation of tail multiply will be to identify two of the generators and give them a new name, W. The operation of head multiply will be the parallel of multiplying words in the free group, which is the BCH product on the Frehley algebra. And finally, the tail on head action will be to replace every occurrence of the letter U by its conjugate by the word corresponding to the generator X. So, except you do this replacement repeatedly. So you replace and then replace again and then replace again. And the point is that when you do the replacement the first time, you get U's appearing in lambda. But the U's that appear in lambda appear deep inside brackets. So the next time you replace, you'll have further U's appearing in the further lambdas that you will get, but they will be even deeper. So, and the Frehley algebra is graded, so the changes that you will see are happening in higher and higher degrees. Okay, well, it's possible that my talk doesn't make sense, but the mathematics so far totally does make sense. Okay, the mathematics so far is totally straightforward, even if I blundered, and it doesn't look like that. Okay, then comes the spice. So I've run out of time, so I'll only say that you add another component to the target space, so you allow cyclic words in the target space, meaning necklaces. And there is a certain spice, well, sort of a little bit like a central extension term that you add, and it's valued in this space of necklaces. I obviously don't have time to tell you how to construct this spice, but it needs to be constructed in a way so that certain equations will be satisfied, so as what you will get will still satisfy the axioms. This is the equation that needs to be satisfied so that the axioms will still be satisfied. And so you need to solve somehow. J somehow should be a solution of this equation. You write this equation in a certain infinitesimal form, and then you can take J to be a solution of a certain differential equation, and well, this constructs J, but it doesn't lead you to understand what J is.
So
yes?
Where's J taking values?
Wheels.
Yes.
So necklaces. Okay? And again, I've run out of time, but the next thing is to just declare the value of the invariant on the generators. I just did, and then the theorem is that this works. Furthermore, the result is, well, the logarithm of a so-called universal finite expansion. Furthermore, it's computable. Everything that I did is absolutely computable, again, even if it's complicated. Furthermore, everything has an interpretation. Once you fix a specific Lie algebra, you can map the Frehley algebra into tensors defined using this fixed Lie algebra. So everything has an interpretation, and it turns out that when you sort of interpret the invariant within a fixed Lie algebra, you get something that looks like the expectation value of a certain TQFT. And I've definitely run out of time, but you know, the next step would be to say, well, this is computable, but it's computable by a degree-by-degree procedure. Okay? It's effective. I can run it rather effectively, but I cannot sum it, and I cannot hope to sum it, because I don't even understand what it means to write a formula for a general element in a Frehley algebra. On the other hand, there are lots of lovely quotients of the Frehley algebra, and here is a relation defining one particularly lovely quotient. modulo this relation, the Frilly algebra becomes almost commutative. So everything has a description in terms of ordinary functions, meaning power series. The BCH formula becomes a specific formula in these variables with exponentials and ugly stuff in it. The J operation, well, the differential equation making J can be solved explicitly. Everything becomes completely explicit and true to all orders. And then you can repackage a bit and get a relative, well, again, I obviously don't have time to tell you about it, but there is a very manageable calculus that allows you to compute the invariant in any quotient, and what you get is a definite improvement over any known formula for the Alexander polynomial. I'll stop 5 minutes later than I should have stopped, and my apologies for making a mess.
Other questions?
Sorry, I obviously tried to say more than I could.
So you mentioned this four-dimensional theory, but presumably your invariant is related to your conjecture.
Yeah.
So I'm just guessing that in that theory, what you're doing is you're labeling the balloons somehow, presumably
so,
by the fundamental representation of G?
No.
No.
So no.
So
again, it's a quantum field theory thing. So wait, where is it? Here. So you know, it's a bit not totally well defined, like many quantum field theories are. So it's a quantum field theory in which there are two fields. There is a one form A and a two form B. Both of them are more precisely, sorry, it's a connection A and a two form with values in the, what is it called, the adjoint bundle B. But let's think of it as a Lie valued one form A, Lie algebra valued one form A, and Lie algebra valued two form B. Both are on R4. You take the path integral with respect to these two fields of the exponential of a certain Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is the B form, the B field wedge the curvature of the A field. So the curvature is a two form, you wedge it with another two form, you get a four form, you can integrate it on R4 and exponentiate, and that's the Lagrangian. Okay? And then there are observables. And roughly speaking, the observables are the holonomies of the one form along the loops times the simple-minded integrals of the two form on the balloons. Okay, so you basically get an observable for each balloon and observable for each loop. You multiply all of them together, you sort of do it correctly, and you get an invariant, well, you get a supposed TQFT invariant, and sort of the what appears to be the case is that, well, that invariant is always a special case, is always a specialization of the invariant zeta that I just described. Sorry, it remains a loose answer, but. Okay.
What level is zeta? Like how much quotient do you have to do to get zeta?
Nothing. None.
Ah.
So zeta is valued in the Frilly algebra, so stuff in Frilly algebras times wheels. So times necklaces. Okay, free words. Okay? Free cyclic words. But then given a specific Lie algebra, every tree represents a formula. right? Whenever you have a freely algebra, you can interpret a tree, so an element of the freely algebra, as a formula that takes as inputs elements of the specifically algebra and outputs an element of the specifically algebra. Likewise, every wheel, sorry, now the Lie algebra has to be finite dimensional, and likewise, every wheel can be interpreted as a formula. Namely, you put elements in your given Lie algebra, finite dimensional Lie algebra, you put them around the wheel, and then you interpret each vertex as a bracket, just like here, and you get a certain trace, which is a number. Okay? So basically, the things that make up the invariant can be interpreted as, well, tensors in that Lie algebra, and the claim is that when you think about it properly, these specializations that you get are the BF expectation values. So the more detailed statement is that given any specific finite dimensional Lie algebra, you can construct a functional e to the tau on the free Lie algebra and the wheels, so that when you evaluate this functional on the invariant that I didn't quite construct, but I was hoping to construct, you get the BF theory expectation values. You know, so it's not clear how much you could have possibly gotten out of it, but I should say in my defense that, first of all, I really mean everything. It's not abstract. Everything actually becomes numbers at the end of the day. It really is computable. And at least you got something entertaining about, I hope you got something entertaining about somehow ordinary tangled concatenation being somehow a semi-direct product once you think about it one dimension up.
Okay. Well, thanks, speaker, again. Thank you.